So, Steve, did anything surprise you last night at the Golden Globes?
Well, one thing a little bit up in the air with George Clooney. I mean, it's a critically acclaimed movie and one that I very much enjoyed. I was a little bit surprised it only won a Golden Globe for Best Screenplay. That was it last night.
And, you know, I was a little surprised that Hurt Locker, which is also an acclaimed drama, won nothing at all at the Golden Globes. And, of course, all this matters because the Golden Globes are seen as a precursor to the Oscars.
And if they are, it's good news for James Cameron's Avatar, which won for both Best Picture and Best Director. We should mention that Mad Men took home the award for Best Television Drama. Monique, Sandra Bullock, Meryl Streep, and Jeff Bridges were all winners for their respective performances.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. And now to the least likely sponsorship in Olympic sports. Tonight, the comedian Stephen Colbert plans to again feature the U.S. speed skating team on his TV show. Colbert decided to sponsor the team after it lost a major corporate backer to bankruptcy. NPR's Howard Berkus reports on this mix of comedy and competition.
The bankrupt bank left a $300,000 hole in U.S. speed skating's ice just as the big push to next month's Olympics began. Then came the phone call from New York and the November 2nd cable cast of the Colbert Report.
Okay, Bob, is this possible? Can the Colbert Nation sponsor U.S. speed skating?
Yes, absolutely.
Where do I sign?
Right here.
Okay. That was U.S. speed skating CEO Bob Crowley getting Stephen Colbert's signature on the sponsorship papers.
Our budget would have had to have been cut in a number of key areas. For U.S. speed skating, this has been a lifesaver, literally.
Now, Stephen Colbert didn't put up any of his own money. Instead, he begged his viewers to send in checks.
We have got to step up and make sure that it is America's 38-inch thighs on that metal platform.
Speed skating is now part of Colbert's blustering comic send-ups of real bloviating talk show hosts. Here he is with short track metal prospect Catherine Reuter.
Let's trash talk the summer games for just a second.
Let's
okay?
do it. Okay.
Guys like Michael Phelps, how easy is it to swim through water? You run on top of water with samurai swords strapped to your feet.
Thank you.
Doesn't
thank
that
you
seem
for
harder?
Seeing that. Definitely.
Reuter is a very serious, hard-training skater who can describe in exquisite detail the technical, physical, and psychological challenges of her sport.
I always want to present myself as a poised athlete, someone who is intelligent and hardworking, and I want for people to be able to relate to me in that way.
Colbert did ask Reuter about her training regimen. And then she asked him to sign his name on her billboard thighs, as she freely calls them. Stunts like that make some wonder whether skaters lose their dignity with the Colbert connection. Long track star Shani Davis called Colbert a jerk. Trip Mickle is the Olympic beat writer for Sports Business Journal.
You got to be wary of partnering with people who might make these sports sticky almost, you know, just something that they aren't, and make them too much about a joke and not about what they really are.
And when Sports Illustrated put a speed skater on its cover, it wasn't Catherine Reuter, it was Stephen Colbert, head to toe in a skin-tight Team USA racing suit. But Mickle believes Colbert has not crossed the line so far, and Reuter agrees.
At the very beginning, we were all a little worried that like maybe he'd poke fun at us. We didn't want our life dream to be turned into something that got poked fun at on Comedy Central, but that has never happened. Like, I feel like I have more support and more people believe in me because of this show.
The sponsorship has had its challenges. At first, Colbert wanted his face on those billboard thighs, but given their varied dimensions and the flexed material, well, he'd have cheeks stretch wide like silly putty. So he went for the Colbert Nation logo instead. And then there's the nasty diss from Shani Davis.
I challenge you to a speed skating race. Any rink, any time, any distance. As long as I get a 1,000-meter head start. If I win, I get your spot on the U.S. Olympic team. But if you win, you get an autographed copy of my Sports Illustrated cover.
Colbert and Davis did race, and the results are shown on tonight's show. Close to 10,000 Colbert viewers sent in more than $300,000, making up for the bankrupt bank. But this is a one-time-only deal. U.S. speed skating still has to find a real sponsor with a long-term commitment. There's hope that the Colbert Report's exposure will make that easier. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The media have spent the last few weeks chewing over the revelation in the book Game Change that Senator Harry Reid said privately that Barack Obama would be acceptable to the electorate because he was light-skinned and had no Negro dialect unless he wanted to have one. According to our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, the responses to Reid's remarks say a lot more about American racial attitudes than Reid himself did.
Just about everybody thought Harry Reid needed to apologize, including Reid himself. But why? You couldn't fault the actual content of the remark, that an African-American presidential candidate has a better chance of being elected if he doesn't look or sound too black. That may be a deplorable reality, but it's not controversial. Even George Will gave Reid a pass. As he put it on ABC's This Week, at long last, Harry Reid has said something that no one can disagree with, and he gets in trouble for it. But according to Liz Cheney, it still shouldn't have been said. She shot back at Will, "Give me a break, George. I mean, talking about the color of the president's skin, it's not the way that people that I know speak to each other." Actually, I can believe that about Cheney's circle. There are a lot of people nowadays who think of skin color as like a piece of lettuce caught in somebody's teeth. You should really try not to see it, and if you do, it's unseemly to bring it up. Reid's use of Negro stirred a similar sense of unease. In the Washington Post, Ezra Klein called it weird, and others went with awkward, unfortunate, or dumb. President Obama called it inartful, which was a deft way of implying that the lapse was purely stylistic. And some called it a racist slur, confusing outmoded with outrageous. But it's never been that. If Negro really were a slur, many older blacks wouldn't still be claiming it as their primary racial identification, and whites wouldn't feel so comfortable about repeating it. Still, the word does have what the African-American linguist John McWhorter called a tangy backwards flavor. And it can certainly be tinged with sarcasm, depending who's using it. Spike Lee coined the term magical Negro as a dig at condescending racial stereotypes in Hollywood films. And the tang was a little more pungent when Rush Limbaugh was playing a record of a white Al Sharpton imitator singing a song called Barack the Magic Negro during the 2008 campaign. But in Reid's mouth, Negro wasn't condescending or contemptuous, just clueless. To be fair, Reid may not use the word except in talking about language. His reference to Negro dialect may have been a garbled version of non-standard Negro English, the term scholars were using for black English until well into the 1970s. And the man isn't exactly styling. If he hasn't changed his racial vocabulary since Jimmy Carter was president, he hasn't changed his eyeglass frames either. But over a quarter century in Congress, he probably should have gotten out a little more. But even if we couldn't agree about its severity, Reid's offense clearly fell under the capacious heading of racial insensitivity. That phrase was introduced in the 1970s to broaden the range of conversational infractions. Even if you weren't an unregenerate Archie Bunker-style bigot, you could still be held accountable for merely being obtuse about race. But the phrase also turned out to be a useful way of enabling out-and-out racism to cop to a lesser plea. In fact, journalists almost never describe any remark as racist anymore. For the New York Times, there was racial insensitivity in Don Imus's reference to nappy-headed hoes, and the L.A. Times heard it in Michael Richards' nightclub tirade. And back in September, National Review's Jonah Goldberg conceded that there was some racial insensitivity in a few of the signs at the Tea Party protests, which included slogans like Save White America and depictions of Obama as a witch doctor with a bone through his nose. The implication was presumably that those protesters could have tried to express themselves more artfully. As the media used the term, racial insensitivity blurs the distinction between one N-word and another, or between Michael Steele's use of honest Injun and Trent Lott's suggestion that the country would have had fewer problems if we'd elected a segregationist as president in 1948. Whether those offenses are venial or mortal, malign or merely thoughtless, by the time they get to YouTube, they're all just gaucheries and gaffes, and they all require the same formulaic apology. Yet almost nobody called Reid to task on the one item that really did betray a deep-seated social prejudice, that word dialect. Of course, as linguists use the word, everybody speaks one dialect or another. Tracy Morgan and Patrick Stewart, Loretta Lynn and Diane Sawyer. But most people reserve the word dialect for varieties of language that are seen as expressive and colorful, but illogical and illiterate. Linguists have been pointing out for a very long time that those varieties all turn out to have a complicated and systematic structure of their own. but it's hard not to hear them through stereotypes of race and class. It's striking how many of the things people say in public about black English are the same things they'd no longer allow themselves to say about the people who speak it. It's slovenly, lazy, ignorant, stupid, broken. Those stereotypes haven't really disappeared from public life. They've just been repurposed as attitudes about language. Everybody likes to invoke Martin Luther King's dream of a nation where no one's judged by the color of his skin. But most people are fine with judging somebody by the shape of his vowels.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Jeff recently sent me a CD by a country singer he really likes who I'd never heard of, but I'm sure glad I know him now. He's Vern Gosden, who died last year. So now I want to play a track for you. This is Chiseled in Stone.
You ran crying to the bedroom. I ran off to the bar. Another piece of heaven gone to hell. The words we spoke in anger just tore my world apart. And I sat there feeling sorry for myself. Then an old man sat down beside me and looked me in the eye. And he said, son, I know what you're going through. You ought to get down on your knees and thank your lucky stars that you got someone to go home to. You don't know about or how long nights can be till you've lived through the story that's still living in me. You don't know about sadness till you face life. It's chiseled in stone.
Now, this next story is also about a photograph, a much older one, actually a daguerreotype from the mid-19th century.
We've had that daguerreotype. It's always been one of our favorites for close to 40 years.
It's one of the first daguerreotypes Jack Wilgus and his wife Beverly got their hands on when they started a collection of old photos back in the 1960s. Now, this particular photo is of a well-dressed, handsome man with a closed eye, and he's holding a metal rod. And for 40 years, Beverly and Jack Wilgus thought the man was a whaler. But then, last year, they started scanning their old photos and posting them to the online photo-sharing site Flickr, and someone noticed that whaler.
It was actually a comment on the photograph.
That photo, the person wrote, is probably Phineas Gage. And who, you might ask, was Phineas Gage?
One of the most famous medical cases that you know by name.
That's Dominic Hall. He's the curator of the Warren Anatomical Museum at Harvard Medical School.
I talk about Phineas Gage every single day in some context or another.
On September 13th, 1848, 25-year-old Phineas Gage was blasting rocks to make way for what would become the Rutland and Burlington Railroad in Vermont.
That day, while he's doing this process called tamping, which is essentially they're drilling holes in large rock, packing in some sort of explosive powder, packing sand on top of that explosive powder, they're laying a fuse and then, you know, and then detonating the fuse.
And he was using a handmade tamping iron to pack those explosives, a 3.5-foot-long iron rod, about an inch in diameter.
You get a couple of different accounts of what happens, but something clearly goes wrong and a spark sets off the charge and the rod is actually fired through Gage's head. It goes all the way through, it comes out the top of his skull and lands about 30 yards away.
The other workers quickly gathered around Phineas Gage as he lay on the ground.
Yeah, they certainly think he's most likely going to die. But he is actually able to with the help of other people, make it over to an ox cart. He sits up in the ox cart and travels to a local inn where he was staying, and that's where he's attended by these physicians, but he actually never loses consciousness at this point.
He's awake the whole time.
He's awake the whole time. He's able to describe his injury.
For 3 months, a local doctor named John Harlow worked on Gage. It was a crude form of what we might now call neurosurgery. And over the next year or so, Harlow started to notice changes in Gage's personality.
Before, he gets described as businesslike, friendly, maybe efficient, responsible. He's good at managing his team on the railroad. After the accident, he's occasionally referred to as childlike, vulgar. He has definitely has some social problems.
Harlow eventually brought Gage to Harvard Medical School to be studied. The students even made a plaster cast of his head, which, along with the iron rod and his actual skull, are still on display at the medical school's museum. Anyway, Gage is examined, and a paper gets published about his condition.
Then he becomes this literal textbook case. He becomes the textbook example.
The textbook example of a post-traumatic personality change. And over the next decade or so, Gage drifted. He spent some of that time as a curiosity act. He worked as a coach driver in Chile. And then he wound up in San Francisco, living with his mother. And in 1860, at the age of 36, Phineas Gage died. The result of seizures most likely related to the accident more than a decade earlier. And up until last year, no one alive really knew what Phineas Gage actually looked like because there were no known photographs or paintings of him. That is, until Beverly Wilgus emailed that scan of her daguerreotype to Dominic Hall at Harvard with a simple question.
Could this be Phineas Gage? And that started the dialogue.
They compared the scars in the image with Gage's skull, and they looked at the iron rod in the photograph and the tamping iron at Harvard's museum, both of which seemed to be engraved with the same inscription.
This is the bar that was shot through the head of Mr. Phineas P. Gage at Cavendish, Vermont, September 14, 1848.
Dominic Hall was stunned.
It's sort of funny, but I have this sort of close relationship with Phineas Gage because of how often I look at his case and think about his case and talk about his case with other people. And so before, when you're only thinking of Gage, you think of a skull or you think of a life cast. But now there's this image.
And you can see that image at our website. That's npr.org.